Hello, listener. Welcome back to the Side B Anthology for yet another installment of Vintage Library, where we will continue reading The Princess and the Plowman. Without further ado, let's read Chapter 4. If thoughts are winged things, more mysteriously alive, more subtly powerful than any exploited energy in the universe, then the action of the girl who was coming toward the man needs little explanation. She was coming to him as the bee had flown to its clover. He saw her when she was yet a little way off and waited quietly for her approach. It seemed to him he had known all along that she would come, that he had already watched her unnumbered times coming to him across the fields, her rich beauty glowing flower-like against the soberer tones of earth and sky. She was a part of his landscape, as the great, white, deep-bosomed clouds were a part of the July heavens. She belonged to him as the bee belonged to its clover. As for Mary, she was wondering confusedly why she had come, and still wondering, she drew yet nearer and looked up into his face. "You wanted me?" he asked confidently. "Yes," she answered. He waited for her to speak further, then, seeing that her face was clouded and tremulous like a child's on the verge of tears, he said, very gently, yet with the authority of a strong man, "Tell me what troubles you. Come, we will sit down under the tree yonder." "How can I tell you?" she said. Then, forlornly, "You could not help me." "Yes," he said, "I can help you. That is why you came to me. I can help you, and I will." She remained silent for a time, under the shelter of the wide-spreading oak, which cast tremulous green shadows on her face and dress. Watching her unobtrusively, he saw the painful swelling of her white throat and the unshed tears shining on her lashes. The sight roused him to vague anger. Involuntarily, his sinewy brown hands clenched themselves. Her eyes turned to him at last. "If I only knew you," she murmured. "You look so strong and kind." "In reality," he answered, "you do know me." His eyes held hers for a long minute. "Now you shall tell me what troubles you," he finished quietly. "It is not," she hesitated, "like any other trouble in the world. It is about Felice."
"You mean Miss Vivian?"
"Yes." She sighed and looked away from him across the fields. "I love her," she added simply.
"And she doesn't love you?" he asked with a slow smile.
"Oh, yes, she loves me as much as I love her, but..." He waited patiently for her to go on. "I haven't anything to build a college with except Aunt Lydia's money," she said. "And I can't have that unless..."
"I'm afraid I don't quite understand," he said with careful politeness.
"Who is Aunt Lydia?" "Aunt Lydia has been dead for 15 years," she told him. "She left all her money to me, to do as I liked with, if I..."
"Would do as she liked?"
"How did you guess it? Aunt Lydia was never married, but she believed every woman should marry. She said that unless I... that I must..."
"She said that you must marry or lose the money?"
"Who told you about it?"
"No one. I guessed it. Or perhaps your thoughts came to me before you did."
"How can thoughts go anywhere?" He shook his head gravely.
"I can't tell you that," he said, "but they do sometimes, especially when one is thinking intently about another person."
"And were you thinking about me?"
I was thinking of you as soon as you came across the field. I had been thinking of you as I worked.
She was silent, gravely considering his reply. Well, then, if you know about Felice and about me and about Aunt Lydia's will, what ought I to do? He blushed stealthily under all his tan.
I don't think I understand about Miss Vivian, he said at last. What has she to do with this?
Mary flashed an astonished glance at him.
If my thoughts had really come to you, she said, you would have known that Felice is the only person in the world I have ever loved.
Then her eyes clouded with fear and regret. Felice says that I ought to marry somebody so that I can have Aunt Lydia's money to build a college in Hawaii with. Aunt Lydia was interested in Hawaii, and if I don't have the money, it is all to go to build a college for women there. But Felice and I, if we had the money, we would build the college and stay together always. We promised, you know, and it would break my heart to leave her.
He trembled a little under the impact of a sudden wild desire.
I don't care at all for the money, she was saying sadly. I can work and earn all that I need. I care only for Felice and for all that we have planned to do together.
She glanced at him doubtfully.
I wonder why I have told you this. I ought not to have told anyone.
On the contrary, he said, you have told me because I am, perhaps, the only person in the world who can help you.
He drew a deep breath.
There is only one thing wanting to put everything right, he went on deliberately. You must marry me.
She shrank away from him, as if frightened at his bold suggestion.
Oh no, she said faintly. I couldn't do that. I shall never marry anyone.
Miss Vivian knows who I am, he went on thoughtfully. At least her father does. I am a thoroughly respectable farmer, quite independent of anyone's opinion and free to do as I please, and I shall be glad to serve you in this difficult matter of the will, in the only way that a man can serve you effectually, and I ask nothing in return.
She was looking at him doubtfully.
Do you mean that you would stay here and let me go away with Felice and build the college? She asked.
Yes.
But would I be obliged to wear a wedding ring and be called by your name? I don't even know your name.
My name, he told her gravely, is Hugh Gent. You may leave the ring in my keeping and bear the name that pleases you best.
Why? She asked, after a long silence. Do you wish to do this for me?
I shall perhaps tell you when you have asked me for the third time, he said, his blue eyes meeting hers steadily. At present, you would not be interested to know.
But if I do not ask you a second time,
I shall never tell you.
She pondered his reply in puzzled silence. After all, she said, it makes no difference. You will marry me, and you will expect nothing from me? You said that you would ask nothing?
I said that I would ask nothing. If I am ever to receive anything at your hands, it will be because you give it to me of your own free will.
I could give you money, she said, meditatively, then drew back, frightened before the sudden blaze of anger in his eyes.
A man, he said, does not accept money from the woman he...
Do not say that to me again, Mary.
I will not, she promised, breathlessly.
But would it be right and kind for me to go away and have everything I wanted and leave you here without anything? I should want to be sure that you... that I... I could never leave Felice. You must understand that,
she finished. I understand, he assured her patiently. You will marry me merely to secure your fortune. I shall be no worse for the transaction, and you will be infinitely better off. It is quite simple, is it not? Any man ought to be willing to perform so slight a service for a woman. She eyed him questioningly. It sounds like a small thing to do, she admitted, but I am afraid it isn't really. And Felice will scold me, or laugh. She often laughs at me, and I think she supposes that I do not know it, but I do. He smiled. And now you are laughing at me, she cried indignantly. But I do not matter, he reminded her. You do not care what I think. No, she agreed. There is really no reason why I should care what you think, and yet, she gazed at him with a child's frank curiosity. I can't help wondering why you are so kind to me, and that makes me care a little, and it was really very odd when one stops to think of it that I should have asked you. I mean, that I should have told you, and not knowing you, not even knowing your name. You said you were thinking about me when you saw me coming? Why should you have thought about me at all? I will tell you sometime, he said. But first, I should like to know why you came. You were coming to speak to me? She shook her head. I was thinking of how I dislike men, she said simply. Particularly one man, and as I was thinking, I just walked along, and presently I saw you. Didn't mean to speak to you. His eyes shone with a sudden splendor of blue light. I was thinking of how, where your delicate feet had touched the earth, green herbage flowering sprang, he said in a low, shaken voice. I disliked to cut out the weeds. They are really flowers, yet it had to be done. She was looking sweetly puzzled. Oh, she said at last, you remember my quotation from Hesiod's Theogony. It was Aphrodite whose delicate feet touched the earth, not mine. And what was it that tracked her steps? He entreated. I haven't been able to recall the second line. Love tracked her steps, quoted Mary softly. An enchanted longing pressed hard after. Then, for the first time in her life, she blushed divinely. He waited till the exquisite aurora had faded, half averting his eyes as if the sight of it were too holy for the eyes of a man. I must be going, stammered Mary, a new and painful self-consciousness tingling in her downcast face. Felice will be wondering what has become of me. Stay with me a moment more, he begged. You will always be with Felice after this, and I, you know, shall be here. There is the marriage to be spoken of. The sooner it is over, the better for you, and for me it does not matter. He drew a little farther away, and his voice steadied to its usual calm, even monotone. I will make all necessary arrangements at once, and tomorrow. Will tomorrow be too soon? No. Mary's lips formed the monosyllable faintly. Must I tell Felice? She asked. Why, certainly, he answered coolly. Miss Vivian is the one chiefly concerned in the matter, I should say. Bring her with you tomorrow. I will provide a second witness. And if I should... Oh, I don't know what Felice will say. I am afraid I have done a very... It is quite all right, he said, with no hint of anything save strong kindness in his tone. It isn't usual, I'll admit. I have asked you to marry me simply to extricate you from a very unpleasant dilemma, and you have, very wisely, decided to accept my service. It will all be over in a matter of half an hour, and then you will be quite free to follow your own wishes. That is all there is to it. She drew a deep breath. Put in that way, she murmured,
It sounds very, very, very matter-of-fact, he finished for her. He was watching her carefully as he spoke. You may put it to Miss Vivian in just that way. She will, of course, make such inquiries as seem best with regard to my general character and eligibility. By that I mean my freedom from any previous matrimonial bond. It will be quite legal and regular, I assure you. Your guardian will be perfectly satisfied that the conditions of the will have been met. She was looking at him with a new anxiety. I forgot, she said, that after this marriage, you will not be free any longer. Suppose you should... She paused, obviously searching for the right words. He waited patiently for the end of her halting sentence. If you should sometime wish to marry someone else, someone you could love and who loved you, what would you do? I will let you know when that time arrives, he told her gravely. In the meantime, do not give yourself the slightest uneasiness with regard to it. That, you will remember, is my affair. Then I do not have to think about you at all, she spoke with an air of mingled relief and resentment. And you will not be obliged to think of me again. You have put it precisely, he said cheerfully. I beg that you will not, after tomorrow, think of me again, and I shall think of you if I choose, she cried. Why should I not think of you? I shall be forced to think of you when I am very happy with Felice, you know, because it will be to you that I owe it all. It would be very ungrateful of me never to think of you. Of course it will be different with you. There will be no reason why you should think of me unless you... Again, he waited imperturbably for the conclusion of her remark, and when it was not forthcoming, he smiled a little, then sighed. She had turned her back upon him and was walking slowly away. I forgot, she said presently, without turning her head, to ask you at what time you... I mean, when shall we... It must be at noon, he said meditatively. When the shadows are underfoot, yes. Let it be this time tomorrow. And the place? It shall be wherever you please. She gazed about her with wide gray eyes, at the blue sea veiled in purest violet, where the sky stooped to clasp it, at the distant dunes shining in the sun, at the peaceful undulations of field and meadow, and the young corn springing at her feet. Why should it not be here? She stammered. He bared his head to the strong sunlight. It shall be here, he said. So that was chapter 4 of The Princess and the Plowman. I have to say, I'm quite surprised by this chapter. This book just keeps surprising me. I have to admit, I didn't think that the topic of marriage, of this marriage that Mary has to have in order to be granted her inheritance from her Aunt Lydia, I did not expect it to be brought up so quickly between the two of them. And I'm really mystified as to why this man so quickly offered her this marriage of convenience and didn't seem at all concerned at the thought that she would just go off and live with Felice in Hawaii while getting the school set up. I know that he says he doesn't want or need anything in return, but I'm really curious as to, I mean, he says that, but There must be some reason. He does hint at it, saying that if she asks him 3 times what the reason is, he'll tell her. But I'm just really mystified. What is his motive here? And I'm not saying that it's not an altruistic motive, but I'm really curious as to why he would offer that. So I suppose I'll just lock in a prediction right now. Maybe this new character, presumably the plowman, Hugh Gent, maybe someone is trying to arrange a marriage for him that he doesn't want to be in, and so this feels like an out for him as well. So it's sort of, she needs to be married and he's being forced into a marriage that he doesn't want. So by marrying each other, they're able to just have their independence. I wonder if maybe that is the motivation here, but we'll have to read on and find out. I did really like the little connection that they made by him remembering what was on one of the pages that had slipped her grasp and been carried away by the wind in the first chapter. But it is a little bit grating to realize that she did not remember who he was at all until he brought that up. She must have really had her head in the clouds. But it is really satisfying that they had that little moment where they built some rapport by this shared interest in the poetry that she had been quoting in what she was writing. And apologies to anyone who is familiar with that writer and that work if I completely mispronounced them. I really wasn't sure of exactly how to pronounce them, and I did not look it up before reading the chapter because I did not read the chapter beforehand. In terms of Mary's characterization in this chapter, it's kind of interesting how we get this sense of her being very naive and kind of blurting things out and also not recognizing this person that she had actually met not that long before, maybe she met him several years earlier. I can't remember if there was any sort of reference to the time passing between chapter 1 and 2. But we see, if you can hear that in the background, that's just Scout licking at his placemat because he wants a little bit more food. So I'm going to give him a little bedtime snack after this is done. So on the one hand, we have Mary being pretty unobservant about the fact that she has actually met this character before. But on the other hand, we have her pointing out that she knows that Felice does laugh at her in kind of a condescending manner and doesn't like it. So she must recognize on some level that Felice is not respecting her. But as to how that will develop and what sort of growth she might go through in the coming chapters, I don't know. I also really like the analogy that Kingsley makes in this chapter of a bee flying to a clover. Now, normally the clover, the flower, would represent the woman and the bee would represent the man, but in this chapter, Kingsley has flipped that script. At least that's my impression. I don't know if anyone else feels that that's kind of the usual way that analogy would play out, but generally in art, it tends to be women that are compared to flowers. I think I'll put a pin in my thoughts there. I find it really difficult to, like, there's a lot of, when I'm doing these little analyses at the end of each chapter, there ends up being a lot of blank space in the recording that I make, because I'm just not used to musing aloud. I'm used to writing it down and to sorting my thoughts out that way. So trying to make my thoughts sound coherent, just speaking them aloud, it's pretty challenging. And when you listen to recordings like this, when you listen to podcast conversations, it always flows so smoothly, partly because of the editing, partly because people are just good at articulating their thoughts in speech in real time. Like, that's, you know, many people can do both very skillfully, but for some people it's really difficult to formulate your thoughts on the fly, speaking them aloud, compared to writing them down I'm struggling to articulate my thoughts clearly when I'm speaking them. It is a little bit easier when it's in conversation, but when I'm just monologuing like this, it's a skill. I wonder if I can hone it. Maybe I'll be a lot better at it by the time I get to the end of this book, but there we go. My brain just isn't letting me speak my thoughts very smoothly the way that I would be able to articulate them if I was writing them down. Or I guess it wouldn't necessarily be articulating if you're writing it. But anyway, I'm getting into the weeds there. So, today, and something that I've been doing more and more often lately is that I went to a cafe with a fellow writer. Usually it's more than one writer friend, but today it was just one writer friend, because none of the other people in our writing community were able to make it out in person. So we just went to a cafe and we did writing sprints in person. It's just so much fun to sit with another writer and do those sprints and then take a break and discuss what we wrote and ask each other questions that help us do deeper world building. It was just so much fun. So, that's all I wanted to mention. It's just really amazing. Having been so isolated before in my writing, to now be part of this local community of writers and to actually be able to sit down with other writers and work on our projects and just really understand what we're each going through, just to understand each other's passion for this this work that we do, even if we're not currently published, even if we are published but we get rejections, there's just something so incredible about the desire to keep creating, even if your creations aren't necessarily being seen by anyone else or appreciated by anyone else. You just still want to create. You see this, like, story. Well, for writers, you see this story, or you experience this story in your head, and you just have to get it down because you want to share it. It's just amazing. And I know that it's similar for other creatives and people in other mediums, but it's just amazing to be able to share that with friends and to have them truly understand what it is that I spend my time doing, because they're spending their time doing this as well, all their free time. Yeah, I'm rambling. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, listener. I'm rambling. So, if you're listening to this in the morning, then good morning. I hope you have an excellent day. And if you're listening to this at night, then what's good? I hope you have a relaxing evening and a really restful sleep. See you next time.